You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
More than 800 wildfires are burning across Northern California today. A lightning storm, officials called unprecedented.
The wildfires burning in California aren't growing, but there is still no sign of relief yet. Northern California now has more than 1,400 fires, and a warning for extreme fire danger remains in effect for today.
You always think climate change will be far away, something that happens in 2030. Then I get an email from my friend, California radio producer Maria Gallardon. Maria brought us specials on climate change through TUC Radio Broadcasting out of San Francisco and carried by other community stations. I wrote telling her about my recent James Hansen program called Climate Criminals. This is her email reply, written June 29th. I have no radio equipment here and fear that if I leave, the California Highway Patrol at the gates will prevent me from coming back. Folks just next to me have already received the evacuation order. Phone may be out soon. Email is okay as long as my house stands, since it is a satellite dish on solar. My very own climate change disaster unfolding around me. Maria. Then a second email. Dear all, here is why I have been out of touch. I'm currently in Mendocino County in the middle of four of the most serious wildfires in our region. The Oro Springs fire has almost reached the Oro Hot Springs, immediately west of here. The Running Springs fire across the road has reached the first dwellings. The Jack Smith and Singley fires have just combined and entered our 5,000-acre association on the northern border. I see that fire out of the window of my handmade straw bale house. We are in a world of drifting smoke. Sun and moon have been orange for 5 days. My neighbors and I are in an amazing effort to prevent the fire from coming down the Box Canyon above us and crossing Redwood Creek and fully entering our land. I have worked on the fire line and on property of my neighbors nearer the fire than I am until Cal Fire sent us away because the fire had breached, again, one of the fire breaks they had bulldozed. They ordered us to go home for our own safety and clear out around our houses. Living so close to a fire is an extraordinary event. The local battalion chief for the Ukiah region compared it to a sleeping dragon on the hill. Each fire has its own character. This one is moving slowly, sometimes turning back onto itself, sometimes consuming 60-foot fir trees in 3 seconds, and then falling quiet again. Wind, moisture, and sun affects its movement and direction. We can hear it groan, or bristle, or crack like a whip, or explode things. For 2 days now, my land partner Jeff and I have been limbing trees, clearing roofs and gutters. Yesterday, out of the blue, a crew of 8 young men showed up with their own equipment, and after 3 hours, our place is unrecognizable. One neighbor even brought a large bulldozer and cut a fire break around our houses. Then they all left and went on to another neighbor's house. Everybody here is packed up to leave on short notice. This morning, the local battalion chief came to meet with us at our community center, the old ranch house. He told us that we would be receiving an evacuation warning that may be followed by an enforceable order. He confirmed that, given the 130 fires in Mendocino County alone, there were no resources to actually fight the fire. The only thing they can do at this time is to try and direct the fires with fire breaks and box it in between those lines and to protect dwellings. He told us, if that line is currently held below our house, if it is breached, that they would regroup 3 miles behind us. In that case, my house would end up inside the box with the dragon. Love, Maria. A few days later, June 30th, Maria is still in the midst of the firestorm. My straw bale house is on 5 acres in the center of the 5,400-acre community, Greenfield Ranch. We are near 3 of the Mendocino County Solstice fires. An earlier letter and maybe future updates are on my website, www.tucradio.org/new. Straw bale houses are fire resistant, but can be destroyed by firefighters blasting the walls with water and setting in motion a composting process that will burn the house later. I have been here for 9 days to do, in cooperation with Cal Fire and my amazing neighbors, as much as possible to prevent the fire from coming further into the ranch and eventually reaching my house. We have been fighting fires directly and creating fire breaks by felling and limbing trees and removing flammables from all around our homes. There are about 300 structures on Greenfield. Today we are exhausted, but confident. Maria. We are reading emails from Maria Gallardin, producer of TUC Radio in San Francisco. Next up. Yesterday was better. We had 3 helicopters making drops almost all day. Finally, after 8 days, it made a huge difference, and we were so happy. Today, the helicopters were pulled out and sent to the Ore Springs fire just down west from us because that flared up. So our fires flared up again as well and are putting out a lot of smoke. These, unlike the Santa Ana fan flames in Southern California, are slow-moving fires. The winds are not that strong in this region at this time of year, 10 to 15 miles an hour, and there is still some moisture at the bottom of the ridges. Traditionally, these fires would have been beneficial, but the sheer number and size is dangerous for all creatures, and of course, most of us humans right here are living in places where no structure should be, and that includes me. Yesterday, Sunday, we drove towards the Jack Smith fire at the north end of Greenfield and looked across the valley at the burned areas, and it is really interesting. This fire next to us is now covered over 1,500 acres. On our side, it has to go downhill, which slows it down, and it mostly proceeded through grass and understory. Whenever it came to a clump of dead firs, and we have quite a few of those, it flared up and created a rust-colored patch on the mountain side. Then it proceeded on the ground. Unfortunately, it is persistent and continues to spawn new extensions. The fire had come up 2 structures and stopped just 100 feet away. CAL FIRE made a commitment to protect homes and also made several fire breaks deep inside Greenfield by running dozers up and down the hillsides according to topography in a wonderful disdain of property lines and fences. The dozer operator who made the fire break at Redwood Creek and around the old ranch house right below me avoided patches of native grasses and Pacific salamander habitat that he was shown. In all this sped-up emergency and midnight work under headlights, there is still room for such care. This really is a statewide emergency, and again, the overall response from the federal level down has been appalling. There are firefighters on the ground here who risk their lives, but all they have is a fire engine, some hand tools, and a few bulldozers. The airdrops from helicopters would have been so helpful early on, but no, and definitely not enough, aircraft was allocated until it was too late to fly due to the smoke. The local town airport had become mostly unusable, too, because the Ukiah Valley had become blanketed with a thick inversion layer. A friend and I began making inquiries into renting our own helicopter for Greenfield and putting it under the command of CAL FIRE. It would have been very expensive, but we thought of creating a coalition with large landowners and a famous vineyard next to us. We asked the local CAL FIRE commander, and amazingly, they would have made use of it. But on that day, a promise had been made by the overall command to allocate aircraft to us. The helicopters that came were somewhat like what we might have rented ourselves from the Yellow Pages in this brave new world of privatization. No military or National Guard of any kind. What came, in addition to one small CAL FIRE chopper, a logging helicopter in the shape of a wasp carrying water where there is space for large redwood logs, a larger one that we called the Flying School Bus with Nevada markings and rows of windows, and a chopper with a built-in tank that hovered way low over the pond and sucked the water up with a 6-inch hose. These pilots were all amazing. From water pickup to drop and return, only 3 minutes or less had passed. They showed impressive skill at dipping bucket on long cables into various small private ponds on the ranch, avoiding clusters of trees, twirling around while gaining altitude and reeling in the cables to the water bucket, rushing towards the smoke plumes and very diligently hovering to put the chopper into just the right position above the flames and releasing a gorgeous waterfall. I was happy, too, they were only able to use water and not chemical fire retardant, which would not have reached the bottom of the forest through the canopy. I took time writing this because, finally, the constant smoke has gotten to me, and I'm indoors using a poor person's air cleaner, a regular square fan with a furnace filter taped to the back that sucks the dusty air that got into the house from the formerly white filter. I can run it for a couple of hours without overtaxing the solar system. Now a neighbor's truck has just gone off the road, and I need to check on it. Bye for now, Maria. Now that's the last word I have from her, now 4 days later. I know Maria is all right. I don't know if she still has her solar-powered home. And that's how it is now. This is Northern California we are talking about, not the dry scrub of the south, the overpopulated area with suburbs, but the normally green and forested northern part of the state. It's hilly to mountainous and mostly wilderness area. Only 20% of the normal spring rains came this year. The dry land burned, set into thousands of fires by dry lightning strikes. My own province of British Columbia will burn every summer for the next 10 years, I predict. The interior pine forests have died, killed by a boring insect formerly controlled by cold winters. The cold winters no longer come. The hillsides and mountain valleys have gone from green to bright red to gray. Next, they will burn to black. We are all on the front lines now. That is why they call it global climate change. Next, we'll hear from a woman fighting the same fear in Canada's north, in the Yukon. The Champagne and Ashkik people have always lived in the forest and from the forest. The community there has met and agreed to set up a watch. They have recorded the elders to know what the land is supposed to look like, what the climate was. The grand forest around them has died, this time not the pines, but the spruce from the spruce bark beetle. The woods have gone gray, the squirrels are disappearing. The elders used groundhogs for fur, but even those are becoming hard to find because the lifeblood of all the species, the forest itself, has died. Like the people of California and so many other places, these people of the woods are now cutting down all trees around their homes. They prepare backpacks and bags to get out quick. Unlike California, probably no fire crews will come at all. The Yukon wilderness is vast. Countless masses of trees burn every year unseen, except by the First Nations people. Carbon pours into the air. All this fits much better into a science fiction novel, until you hear the story from people who live it, in California, in Iowa, in Myanmar, in China, in Australia, or the Yukon. Scientists from all over the world are hitting the panic button. Later in this hour, you'll hear from one of Canada's top climate scientists and an IPCC contributor, Dr. Gordon McBean. But first, let's hear from the ground, from the Yukon. Here is Rose Kushnirik, Champagne and Ashkik First Nations, Chair and ALSEC Resource Council, speaking at a conference called Extreme Events, Adapting to Climate Change, in Vancouver, June 2, 2008, and recorded by Radio EcoShock.
My First Nation, we are a self-governing First Nation. We've been self-governing for about 13 years, and we have an agreement that allows us to do all these things, to look after our lands and resources and to be partners in how we manage and develop legislation and policies. And the reason why I want to say that, you know, we do have all these abilities, but like climate change, none of it's going to work if we don't develop true partnerships and work together as a whole community or as a whole planet, I guess. At our First Nation, we spend a lot of time out on the land. An elder had once told me, if you don't get out on the land, you might forget it. And so we... In our department at home, it's really important that we spend a lot of time out on the land. So we make provisions for that within our whole organization to allow for people to go out on the land to document our historical places. We have community hunts. We do our own training exercises out on the land. We do training with youth. We have our own science camp. We teach kids how to have bush skills, so to speak. And we do all this because it is important to have, another elder had quoted, one hand on the computer and 1 foot on the land. And, you know, our elders tell us that that's very important as well. Our first real visible change that occurred that caused us to do a lot of different planning was the spruce bark beetle. And like BC, you guys have the mountain pine beetle, but we have the spruce bark beetle, and that first occurred in 1994. It came to the public's attention that, you know, this, we did have a small infestation before, but now it's growing even, you know, really, really big. And here's just some pictures of how how gray and how dark it is, and just how much it's changed. We have extreme fire behavior, or a high fire risk, and that came out really loud and clear in our planning processes that we have to try and work to reduce the fire risks in our communities. Our land is changing, and it's changing fast. We know our land is always changing, but what I think in our community, what people were having a hard time with is that, wow, this is like overnight, and a lot of our food sources are changing. There is more and less of some animals. There's less grouse, less squirrels out in the trees. Our elders have told us that, or they're the ones who brought it to our attention first, was that, wow, how come there's no more squirrels around? And it was alarming. I wanted to mention that we're not the only ones in a spruce bark beetle or infestation. It started first in 1989, 1990 in the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, our neighbors. And so we went to them and we tried to learn a lot from them about what did they do and, how did they cope with it and educate their community on that change. So we went over to the Kenai, and they also have the infestation occur in a little bit more east to them in the Copper River Basin, and then here we are in the Elsat River Kluane area. And if you look all along down the west coast, that's where all the beetle infestation is happening, including British Columbia and into the United States. We have been trying to do incentive programs to reduce the fire risk by clearing people's cabins, even having little draws to get people to fire smart their properties. We've been trying to incorporate different, within our land disposition processes to allow for, to make it easier for other uses to happen. One of the big things that came out of this was our emergency measures planning. We planned first to have, because of, evacuation in the event a fire came through our town, but it just brought up so many other things in this whole process. We started talking about everything that's happening all over the world and, what could happen in our communities. We talked about the honeybees. We talked about our weather changing in the wintertime. We talked about power outages, and when we have a power outage in the north, it's almost crazy not to have a wood stove in your house. And amazingly so, a lot of houses do not have wood stoves in them, and it's kind of crazy to live that way when you think about it. So we talked about the increase in gas and food, and especially being further north, prices probably are going to be higher. So what do we need to do there? We need to look at how we can make our communities more self-sufficient. We talked about different floods. We talked about this one was in Langley, and then that triggered us to talk about floods in our local areas, because we have some of our rivers are damming up with the ice now a lot more, and we're starting to see a lot of back flooding. We talked about earthquakes. I live by the Kluane National Park, and it's on a big fault, and there's always little earthquakes happening back there. This was a picture of the earthquake that happened in Alaska in the 60s, and it was pretty big and devastating. We talked about pandemic planning and what we would do as a community and how we would how we plan to live. We also did a session to introduce climate change to our community, and it was called Climate Change in Our Backyard. And we brought people from a mixture of people, scientists and community people, to hear from them their observations of change. It was also a venue to build relationships and respect between the scientific community and the local knowledge community. at this session, which was really important, is that we wanted to introduce research and monitoring and how important that it was, because we thought our community, in a sense, research and monitoring has like a bad name. People are like, oh, you want to study and you want to plan and you want to just keep doing all this. What do you want to do it for? So we thought we really need to spend time and introduce that to our community. And we had to share with them the importance of all knowledge, scientific, local, and traditional knowledge. And we shared with them that each has a part of everything and complements each other. At times, we shared with them that, you know, often science can only tell us so much sometimes. And research and monitoring only goes back so far in the Yukon. It wasn't, we haven't been writing down things for a long time. I was talking to some people earlier about the first impact of the non-native people was just over 120 years ago. So it's not that long ago that we really started to record and document our observations of change. We have people out on the land all the time. We've made it a priority. We have a monitor. He goes out and he's always looking and reporting changes. At our session, we brought people from Australia. They had said, your glaciers are melting, our islands are sinking. So this session, we got to hear from people about the large mammals, the changes they're seeing, about the small mammals, the changes they're seeing. So we got a whole bunch of background information about their observations of change. So now where we're at with the community is that we need to have a part two, an action planning meeting. At this session, it was very important. We engaged our youth, and we try to engage our youth in a lot of different things. Here are just some pictures of people, local people, planning together. One of the things, when we brought our a neighbor over from Alaska, we told he came over and he said, you have to really get your community to embrace and accept and work with change. And change is always scary. I want to share with you, I got the 2-minute note here, a story. When we're talking, the next topic I want to talk about is our change in glaciers, and this is an example of traditional knowledge. There is a story about a shaman a long time ago that climbed up to this mountain, and he had, or prior to climbing up to the mountain, he heard, or this young person was making fun of him, and he didn't like it. So he climbed up to the mountain, and he called a glacier. And the glacier came forward, and it blocked off the Elsack River. And the story goes on. He later went back up and called and told the glacier to go back, and the glacier moved back. Well, this event did happen. Science tells us that this glacier has, the Lowell Glacier had come forward, surged, and blocked it off and made our area into a big lake where I live right now. Well, this event is, it's not the same glacier that's happening, but this is a slide of a Tweedsmere Glacier, which is down from the Lowell Glacier. And this is it in November 2007. And this is now it in April 2008. So you can see how much this glacier has moved forward in such a short time. And, you know, as it's about 350 meters that it's moved, and we don't know what it's going to do, if it's going to slow down or if it's going to keep going, and what happens if it goes across the whole Elsack again? Will it block everything off? And who knows what we'll do with it? But so we have a real big change happening in the glaciers in our backyard. And I had some slides here just of some other glaciers next door to us in Alaska, the changes of them over the years. This is the Riggs Glacier in 1941, that in 2004. So there's a lot of changes happening in our glaciers in our backyard. It's the largest non-polar ice field in the world. right in the Kluane National Park. So we have to observe those and watch those changes. Also, I'll tell one more climate change mystery, so to speak. My time's up, but we have the Kokanee salmon in our area, and they're landlocked salmon. They were trapped there when the Lowell Glacier surged, and they're virtually parasite and disease-free fish, and they spawn in small streams. A while ago, over the years, there's been an average, like since the 70s, since we've been monitoring them, there's been around 2,800 to 3,000 Kokanee salmon counted every year. Well, in 2002, there were 700 counted. 2003, there was 160 counted. 2004, there was 56 counted. 2005, it's around the same, about 56 to 66 salmon, Kokanee salmon being counted now. So it's a real big mystery. We don't know what is happening to them. It's virtually overnight that this fish population has been changing. It could, because where they live is a real cold lake and there's a lot of, with our changing forest, maybe it's the needles dropping into the spawning grounds that are changing. We don't know. So I'll leave it with that. I think my time's up. I had a few more things to go over with, but because we did have a few real warm winters, and we do a lot of stuff with the gopher, and the gopher's population just crashed because where they were hibernating, when it was supposed to be snow in the winter, it was rain, and it drowned them while they were hibernating. So we had a lot of our gophers disappear for a while, and they're starting to come back. And I guess that's what I'll leave it with for right now. This was just a quick example of erosion from, where's the road? This is 1 year virtually this happened. The road goes over to the left, but so there's all kinds of those changes happening out there as a result of our changing forest, because the forest is the blanket to our land, and when that changes, so many other things changes, right from the aquatic life to everything. So thank you.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. I want to tell you a bit about our summer programming for the next month. Nature is calling me out of the city, out of the noise. But I'm going to leave you with a whole month of noise, some great audio you need to hear. Next week, we'll go back down under, where there is a thirst for climate action now that the everlasting drought has come. The Australian state governments and then the new federal government of Kevin Rudd hired the country's top economist to find a cure. Professor Ross Garnaut is world known and an expert in Asian affairs as well. This past week, Professor Garnaut laid down his report. It isn't optimistic. In fact, he thinks that perhaps vested interests will stop the progress of humankind. But it is a start, and I think the new American government, whoever wins the presidency, will rip whole pages from the Garnaut report. The whole world will be watching. I prepared a recording of Garnaut from some months back, which outlines the challenges facing any developed country as we reach energy limits and climate change in a newly competitive world. Don't miss Professor Ross Garnaut next week on Radio EcoShock. The week after is our one and only rerun of this year. Not because good audio is lacking, but because I think we all need it. It's called Coping with Climate Change, a special hour from our 2007 season. I interview a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and a global warming historian, asking them, how do we handle the mental stress of knowing the climate is shifting? In the following 2 weeks, you'll hear a new speech from Dr. David Suzuki and a briefing from Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society. Then we'll bring in some new talent. KMO is a podcaster who gets unbelievable guests and gets them talking. We'll listen in as KMO chats with David M. Bushnell, chief scientist at the Langley Research Center of NASA. It's an odd mix. KMO also specializes in Amazonian shamanism. A Pentagon advisor unloads on extreme climate change and organic solutions that could save us, not nuclear power, but energy-making microbes in desert seas. hear, and believe. All that and more coming up on Radio EcoShock. Be sure and join us for a hot summer season. I don't want to tell you too much about the fall, but I will let you in on some of my summer reading. I have George Monbiot's new book, Bring On the Apocalypse. He's agreed to come on the show. My horror reading is Under a Green Sky by Peter Ward, who recently wowed the TED conference in California. And I've recorded some fresh ideas on how movements start and how they die from the legendary California activist Tom Hayden. First, I'm going to go through the Tom Hayden reader because I want to know how you and I are going to turn this world around. A revolution in social action is needed. Build it or burn. All together. Radio EcoShock will be right back in 30 seconds.
If we look at the rate of increase of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere in the 1990s, it was going up at about 1.3% per year. We're now going up at 3.3% per year. And the projections, the actual measured amounts or estimated amounts for 2006 in terms of greenhouse gas emissions are larger than even the most pessimistic projections made only in the year 2000. So not looking very good.
Recorded June 2, 2008 by Radio EcoShock.
Our first speaker is one of Canada's most highly acclaimed climate scientists and a pioneer in the field of planning for climate change and its impacts. Among his many accomplishments, Dr. Gordon McBain was a lead author for the first and second IPCC assessments and a review editor for the fourth. He's currently a professor at the University of Western Ontario and policy chair for the Ontario-based Institute for Catastrophic Loss Reduction. Welcome, Gordon.
Hello, this is Alex Smith. Last week on the Radio EcoShock show, we featured a speech by geologist Andrew Glickson. In our email exchange, Dr. Glickson attached an urgent letter from Australian scientists to the Australian government and the public. It was called Last Call for Climate Change. It says, quote, "Scientists judge the risks to humanity of dangerous global warming to be high. The loss of the Great Barrier Reef now seems likely. Extreme weather events, such as storm surges, adding to rising sea levels and threatening coastal cities, will become more frequent. There is a real danger that we have reached or will soon reach critical tipping points and the future will be taken out of our hands," end quote, from the Australian scientists. In fact, scientists from around the world are sounding the alarm. We have only a few years, perhaps only 3 to 7 years, left to avoid complete climate disaster, including mass extinction of the species. In Canada, over 100 of the top climate scientists have sent an open letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, calling for urgent action to reduce greenhouse gases. Quote, "New analysis show that global greenhouse gas concentrations are increasing, sea levels are rising, and Arctic sea ice decreasing faster than projected only a few years ago." The letter was organized by Dr. Gordon McBain. Here is his presentation to the Extreme Events Adapting to Climate Change Conference in Vancouver this June.
What I wanted to do was very quickly talk about some of the climate change science as an introduction to my colleagues who will give you more, let's say, relevant issues around. And so first of all, let's talk about the global temperature change. If we look at the last 100 years, 150 years, we have a sort of a slope like so. Last 100 years, Over the last 50 years, the climate has been warming at about 0.13 degrees C per decade, and over the last 25 years, it's warming at a rate of 0.18 degrees C per decade. The evidence is unequivocal. The climate system is changing. It is getting warmer through both all kinds of observations. And I think the other thing we're seeing is that not only is the climate changing, but the analysis shows that humans are most of the cause. I'm in the business of natural hazards, so I think, first of all, I want to just very quickly say a hazard is something that may potentially cause us damage to a community, and vulnerability are the conditions determined by the physical, social, economic, environmental factors that determine how susceptible communities are. And it's when we get these two working together, disasters result when hazards hit a vulnerable community. So we have to deal with both factors here. If we look around the world at global natural disasters, and they're natural only in the sense they were triggered by an event such as weather, climate, we've gone from about 50 weather-related disasters per year in the 1960s to almost one per day in the first part of this century. If we look at them, the economic costs are going up. And if we look at all of the disasters that happen around the world, although the earthquakes, when they happen, are really horrific, they are only a small number percentage-wise. The over 75% of the disasters around the world are caused or triggered by floods, storms, droughts, landslides, snowslides, things that are related to our weather and climate. So as our climate is changing, we are concerned about that. So, is our climate going to be changing more in the future? I think the answer is yes. First of all, remember, over the last 50 years, we're warming at a rate of 0.13 degrees C per decade. We'll be warming, then we've been warming at 0.18 for the last 25 years. And for roughly the next 25, 30 years, the scientific consensus is that we will warm at a rate slightly more, 0.2 degrees C per decade, independently of emission scenarios, because the climate system is still, quite frankly, catching up with the amount of greenhouse gases that human activities are put in. As we look towards the longer period of time, if we take a very optimistic scenario, we could, in fact, bring the rate of warming down to 0.15 degrees C per decade by the end of the century. But if we continue on a very pessimistic upwards careening slope of greenhouse gas emissions, we could be warming at a rate of 0.8 degrees C per decade by the end of the century. That's what we might call our human choice. And we first of all have to recognize there is scientific uncertainty, and if we factor that in, we could be warming by a degree or so by the end of the century. We could be warming by as many as 7 degrees by the end of the century. And that is really the latter number, really horrific. And the warming will continue for centuries to follow. So where are we going on our greenhouse gas emissions? Let's leave that to other audiences, but I just want to say that things are not looking great. This is from the Global Carbon Project, their latest report in 2007. If we look at the rate of increase of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, in the 1990s, it was going up at about 1.3% per year. We're now going up at 3.3% per year. And the projections, the actual measured amounts or estimated amounts for 2006 in terms of greenhouse gas emissions are larger than even the most pessimistic projections made only in the year 2000. So not looking very good. Anyway, if we look at our simple climate framework, we normally think of it going around in this kind of loop. And much of the discussion is on emission reductions, i.e. changing our socioeconomic development paths to reduce emissions. But what we're really going to talk about here in this workshop tonight is climate change adaptation, which is changing the way we do things in order to minimize the impacts of a changing climate, gain whatever advantages there may be, and trying to manage the unavoidable, as we might say. So, adaptation is defined in this way, making adjustments in our decisions, activities, and thinking. We can be informed by knowledge of current and projected impacts and vulnerability up. So it's the kind of thinking ahead, making choices, understanding that the climate is changing and it will evolve with time, so we need to step forward in an iterative kind of way. We need to build our adaptive capacity. That's the capacity of societies to be able to adapt to a changing climate. And this is all linked to disaster risk reduction. So very quickly, remember, first of all, that no one lives at the global average. When we say that the global temperature is going to warm by 2.8 degrees Celsius, that means that most land areas are going to warm by over 3.5 degrees, and the northern regions of Canada, the Arctic, could be warming as much as 6 degrees Celsius. There's a very large northern expansion of this. We also need to look at precipitation patterns, and on a global basis, there are many places with reduced summertime precipitation, including the central interior of British Columbia, the southwestern Canadian prairies, areas that are already dry, will in the summer get even drier. We'll also have, though, increased wintertime precipitation through actually most of Canada, including the coastal zones here. This means we need to look at our water supply systems, our flood management, hydropower, how do we deal with sewage, rethink what we're doing, and how do we do it. I'm from Ontario now, although I grew up in Vancouver, so I just want to show you an Ontario event. These kind of things happen. This is August 19th, 2005. All this happened in a matter of minutes. A major street in Toronto is wiped out, and that hole in the ground, but more importantly, the water that went all over the place into people's basements cost the Canadian insurance companies $500 million in payouts for an event that lasted about 10 minutes. Those are the kind of events, that's not necessarily due to climate change, but we are now projecting that those kind of heavy precipitation events will be more likely, and again, we need to account for that in our planning. We will have more flash floods, more kinds of issues to deal with as we look to the future. Drought conditions, summer drying, the possibility of more fires in the interior, droughts on the prairies, again, agricultural systems, water supply systems. One of the things we worry about is tornadoes. You don't have many tornadoes in BC, but we have lots of them on the prairies and actually in southwestern Ontario where I live. And this is an example of a tornado hitting Ely, Manitoba, in which fortunately no one was killed, but that was the first F5 tornado to ever be known to happen in Canada. Not necessarily due to climate change, but the indications are that as we look to the future, the occurrence of these kind of severe weather events will increase in number. We've already, as mentioned by Deborah, the tragedy happening in Burma, the earlier tragedies of Katrina in New Orleans, etc. The number of those kind of cyclones may not go up in the numbers of them, but the magnitude, the intensity of them is going to increase with time. We're already seeing more high intense hurricanes happening, and that will continue into the future. With the melting of ice, we can only say we think there will be just a sea level rise. And again, we're concerned because if we look at the sea level rise over the last decade or so, is that the curve we're following, riding up that, is where the sea level is now rising for the last decade or more at a rate which was on the upper edge of what we thought would have been possible. So in other words, we're going into the worst of the scenarios in terms of sea level rise. This, with the addition of the fact that storms in the future will be more intense, leads us to concerns about storm surges affecting coastal communities. I just want to mention in passing, we need to also worry about other things related to our health as we have hot or drier conditions. We may have more mosquitoes, the spread of West Nile virus we've seen in the interior of British Columbia. With the warming winters, the overwintering of pests, etc., in the mountain pine beetle. So climate is changing. It is changing and affecting all kinds of our ecosystems, the society, etc. And we need to also remember that climate change is a long-term issue. It's an issue in my feeling about intergenerational and international equity. And it gets down to people like my two grandchildren and my wife. We worry about those people. I do, and I think you all do. And how is the climate we're leaving for them and for the people in, say, Africa, where they are being impacted by climate change, going to be such that they are having significant issues already now, and as the climate makes it more difficult for them in the future?
I have become quite concerned, I think, because of the news items of the cyclones in Burma, but also the over 1,000 tornadoes in the Midwest of the United States. So I'm wondering, to our guests from University of Western Ontario, perhaps, what are you hearing from other scientists? Is there a consensus of opinion? Is this just a bad year from El Nino and these things happen? Or is this possibly a destabilization of our climate showing up in these strong storm signals?
Well, it's very hard to say that a given event like the Myanmar cyclone is due to climate change. But the evidence, if I can just talk about the cyclones for a minute, the evidence is that we have seen, if you compare detailed observations from satellites, which give you a consistent global database, that for the, say, 15 years up to 1990, and then compare with, say, 1990 to 2005. So you've got two 15-year periods, is the number of intense cyclones, or hurricanes as we call them in our hemisphere, has gone up in all ocean basins. The climate models indicate that we will see in the future not necessarily more cyclones, hurricanes, but those that do occur will typically have higher intense precipitation intensities and higher peak wind speeds. So the events, as we've seen, the tragedy of Myanmar, is the kind of thing that we would have said 10 years ago we should expect to see more of, and now we say now we'll see even more of them again in another 10 years. So it's not a sudden abrupt change, but those are consistent with what we would expect to see in view of the increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. The tornadoes are a bit harder to say because they're so small in a statistic, but anyway, the atmosphere is becoming more energetic, and those kind of extreme events are becoming documented to becoming more prevalent in the last decade or so, and we expect that to continue to increase in the future. I work for what's called the Institute for Catastrophic Loss Reduction, which is focusing on disaster risk reduction. I actually chair an international program which is called Integrated Research on Disaster Risk.
That was Dr. Gordon McBean, a top Canadian scientist, speaking at the Extreme Events Conference, June 2, 2008, in Vancouver.
Well, there won't be any more concerts for a million years or so, and no nice little dinners at restaurants. If it's amusement you're after, I guess the game's up.
What is there left?
Life, that's what. I want to live. Yeah, and so do you.
Faucet drips, the floorboard squeaks, the roof is always leaking. What do you do when you got a loose screw? Fix it or stop complaining. There's a hole in the bucket, there's a hole in the shoe, a hole up in the ozone. There's a hole in the screen and I just got bit. Fix it or stop complaining. Give it your best, get a good grip. Give it more elbow, a little less lip. Ask for help if the job's too big. Fix it or stop complaining. The car's in the ditch, it won't run. The fuel line, it is broken. And the driver wants to buy more gas. Fix it or stop complaining. There's a wolf at the door, licking his chops, a weasel in the hen house. What do you do when the lock is broke? Fix it or stop complaining. Give it your best, get a good grip. Give it more elbow, a little less lip. Ask for help if the job's too big. Fix it or stop complaining. There's too much fat, not enough meat. There's more talk than listening. When a fool's in charge, who put 'em there? Fix it or stop complaining. There's a crack in the deck, the rudder's gone, the sail, it needs mending. You and I are in the same boat. Let's fix it and stop complaining.
That's New England musician Dan Berggren, and this is Radio EcoShock with something completely different. With food prices running high, maybe unsafe factory farms, and a doubtful economy, you might need to learn what your grandparents all took for granted, how to raise chickens. Of course, there's radio for that too. The Bucky Buckaw Backyard Chicken Broadcast comes from Boise Community Radio. We have Bucky on the line now. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Why do we need chicken radio?
Well, I think radio is just a good kind of old-fashioned way of reaching people, and but also new. It's something that there's a renewed interest in, and people are really responding to it. And I had the opportunity in Boise, Idaho, to have a show called the Sagebrush Variety Show, and one of the segments was the Bucky Bacall Backyard Chicken Broadcast. And there's sort of a parallel there with radio and chickens, because chickens is old. There was a time, not too long ago, 50 to 80 or 100 at the tops, years ago, when most people had chickens in their backyard, urban or rural. That was before there really were a lot of suburbs, so to speak. And in most nations across the globe, planet now, there's still a lot of urban chickenry going on.
Absolutely. But, you know, one persistent question I have is, it seems like so many municipalities have bylaws against having chickens. Is there a way to get around that, or is there hope for the suburbanites or even city folk to raise their own?
Well, you know, the irony for me and my experience, I'm here in the United States, which in a lot of ways isn't the most progressive part of North America, but actually has less restrictive rules on backyard chickening. That's been my experience. In fact, on the Bucky Bacall Chicken Broadcast, I'm often saying that it's actually legal in more cities than not to have chickens. But I've been learning about folks in Canada, and I've been actually talking to a lot of people who were sort of outlaw chickeners and their experience. And basically, you know, having those restrictions, like, it's sort of like with art. When you have a restriction, sometimes it forces you to be more creative and end up with a better product. And when you're legally not allowed to have chickens, it forces you to have a much closer relationship with your neighbors and work some of that stuff out on the front end. I know I've been fortunate, because I haven't had to experience that. I've talked to a lot of people who've done a lot of real community work on the front end to convince their neighbors not to turn them in. Or they've been prepared to sort of be able to make their chickens a little more secret, which I think is sort of a pity and also pretty much an impossible task.
Especially if you have roosters. I mean, roosters are the big giveaway. Do you need roosters in order to get some egg going?
Well, it's funny you bring that up. You know, I encounter that question all the time, and then yet I still sort of forget and take it for granted that a lot of people don't realize that you don't need a rooster to get eggs. Just kind of like most species, the female does not need a male around to go through the reproductive cycle to give birth to me, but not to produce whatever form of eggs they make. And that's the case with chickens. In fact, most urban chickeners in the United States part of North America stick to hens, either because they just don't want to irritate their neighbors, or because even though chickenry is generally legal in the United States, roosters are generally not in urban areas.
Well, you can understand why. They do wake you up right at the crack of dawn.
Well, it's kind of a service, really, I'll tell you that. You know, I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, there was a time when roosters were better guard dogs than dogs. And compared to, you know, I've lived in Boise, Idaho, and New York City, in Dallas, Texas, and at all hours of the day and night, there's been all kinds of noises that I find a lot more irritating than roosters. I guess it's just a matter of what you get used to. I mean, airplanes, dogs, people having drag races. I actually gotta tell you, if your neighbors don't like your roosters, I understand that. But to me, of all the urban noises that you can experience, roosters is just about the nicest one. And the other thing is, there are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of trial error involved with this, but some roosters make more noise than others. And there's a lot of sort of folk wisdom about trying to keep roosters quiet, and some of it is pretty much flim-flam. But I've found that if you can really keep a lot of light out, and you can kind of create an environment where it's dark and quiet, you can suppress a lot of that sort of rooster's natural tendency to make a lot of noise at, say, 3 or 4 a.m. and kind of put it off until you let them out around 8 a.m.
Well, that's some good advice. And, Bucky, here's where I tell my tale, hopefully setting a new low for radio. Most people raise chickens for eggs, but there are meat varieties as well, and that meat can get you through a cold winter or hard times. And, of course, you would know an older hen that won't lay anymore just uses up your costly food or grain. So sooner or later, the chicken hits the pot. So I'm going to alienate most of my vegan listeners, but I have to pass on the way that I learned to kill chickens when I raised them in the North. First of all, you can forget all the cartoons about trying to hold down chickens while whacking away with an axe and maybe hurting yourself. An old Irish lady taught me the safe and sane way, I think, to put down a chicken with the least pain and upset for them. You start by cornering the bird, grabbing a foot. Haul the chicken upside down and grab the other foot in the same hand. Then reach down and pin both wingtips into that same hand. You can do it. The chicken just goes limp. Since there's not much they can do, there's no further struggle. You take the chicken away from the other birds. Nobody needs to see that. And then, still holding the bird upside down, take your other hand and place it so the back of your hand is under the bird's throat. Bring your two largest fingers up around the chicken's neck and grasp it. Then all you have to do is swing your arm up so that you snap the chicken's head straight backwards, breaking the neck. Now the bird feels no pain, and after a little bit of flipping, it's dead. In my experience, that is the best time to pluck the bird. Feathers come out much, much easier when the chicken is still warm. If you had cut the head off and hung it to bleed, then the plucking is way harder because the bird is too cold. Once the chicken is plucked, then you can remove the head and drain out the blood and make sure you know where it's going, because maybe some large animals will come around later to inspect. And don't forget, you still have to dip the carcass in a big pot of boiling water to soften the bristle hairs that remain. Scrape those hairs off with a knife, and you're ready to go. And Bucky, I think maybe we should leave the details about how to gut a chicken for some other program, shall we?
Sure, that sounds just fine. I got to tell you, I wasn't too offended by that, and I'm an ex-vegan. I guess I was never a particularly squeamish one, and my decision had a lot to do with sustainability and sort of understanding and knowing where my food comes from. So I do respect people like yourself who have experience with butchering their own chickens. But one thing I will say to people who are worried to thinking about if they're going to have to get into the business of slaughtering if they want to have eggs, that a lot of the heritage, and not rare, but just sort of like not made for factory breeds of chickens, will lay eggs for quite a long time, will make quite a few eggs. In fact, I just did an interview with a woman who just got started with chickens, but she was inspired by her neighbor, and her neighbor had a chicken that was laying eggs after 10 years. So a lot of the older breeds of chickens will continue to lay eggs, and you can sort of make the determination about whether or not their poop, which is a great fertilizer, and whether their bug control is a benefit that's worth the cost of keeping around and feeding them kitchen scraps and whatnot. But I do understand that getting through the year, if you're truly living a sustainable life, I'm totally open to that, and I'm actually gonna hold on to your advice there, because there may come a day when I need to slaughter a chicken. So I really appreciate that.
Well, what advice do you have for us for getting the hens to lay and keeping them happy?
Well, I always say that the best eggs that I ever tasted were from chickens who had a diet rich in bugs. So if you have neighbors who don't have chickens yet, you can do a little bit of outreach and take them around and sort of debug the rest of the neighborhood with no fertilizer. Rich greens like kale. If you just have a little extra kale in your garden, kale sure grows heartily. A lot of times you can spare a little bit out of your garden for the chicken, or they'll just eat the little scrappy parts that you're not interested in. Sometimes if you live in a city, you can sort of freeganize some kind of yellowish kale from the dumpster of the local co-op or whatnot. And you just feed them well and make sure that some of the eggs they lay, you always save a few eggshells, grind them up so they don't recognize what they are, and let them feed that so they get enough calcium. But really, any time you take care of a chicken, take care of it right, a hen, she's going to continue to lay eggs for a while.
And you have a website as well?
Yes, that's easy. It's www.buckybacall.org.
And Buckaw is spelled B-U-C-K-A-W, for those who don't know, and that was Bucky Buckaw from the Backyard Chicken broadcast, originating out of community radio in Boise, Idaho. I really want to thank you for coming on the show, Bucky.
Thanks a lot.